Welcome, everyone, to the latest edition of Mini Signs 2012. My name is Martin Grant, and yes, I'm still the Dean of Science at McGill University. Last week, we had a talk from Jennifer Bartz, and we have a skill testing question for our trained scientists or mini scientists here today. And Jennifer gave kind of a complicated answer to this question, but anyway. So, if the taking of Tylenol reduced social pain over a period of 3 weeks, should people with broken hearts reach for a bottle of Tylenol? We have an excessively shy crowd here today. Yes, that was a firm and authoritative yes. So I'll read you what Jennifer says. The answer is yes, okay? If it's yes, no. This study is a step in the right direction, but circumspection is necessary. Emotional pain is necessary in life. Biologically, emotional pain and physical pain are both a reaction of the brain to neurotransmitters, and they work together to keep the body in order. We need emotional stability as well as physical safety in order to achieve equilibrium and get rid of pain. So there's kind of the depressing answer. That's good for you, so just hold on. Okay, well, all of you know the drill now. At the end of the talk today, you'll be asked to write questions. There are extra marks, of course, for legibility, and I will attempt to guess the gender of the person who wrote the question from the quality of the handwriting, however inappropriate that is for me to say on Kennel Savoie. Please don't ask any questions you wouldn't want me to address to our speaker today in front of an auditorium. And at the end, I'd appreciate if you'd fill out the evaluation forms and pass them back to our volunteers who are helping us here tonight. Okay, tonight's mini science title, as you can see behind me, is Helping People with Pain Resume Occupational Involvement. Our speaker is Dr. McSullivan. He holds a professorship in psychology, medicine, neurology at McGill University, and a cross appointment with the School of Physical and Occupational Therapy, and is the scientific director of the University Center for Research on Pain and Disability. His talk will highlight some of the psychosocial factors that have been shown to contribute to occupational disability in people who have pain conditions. The results of recent intervention trials will be described, showing how you can target disability-relevant psychosocial risk factors, and this can be an effective means promoting a return to work, in individuals with persistent pain conditions. Okay, so we're going to have a very nice and very interesting talk today. With that, I give you the mic.
Am I plugged in? We're good? All right. Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction, for the invitation to speak to you, and thank you for taking the time out of your schedules to come and watch me talk. It's always nerve-wracking giving a talk on your own turf, you know? And although I must admit I was really embarrassed, I didn't know where this building was, and I've been here. And So I'm going to tell you a bit about some of the work that we've been conducting, trying to understand some of the psychosocial factors that can impact on disability that's associated with pain. And some of the material that I'm going to be touching on is a bit different than some of the issues or questions that have been addressed probably in previous talks, where I'm going to be focusing mostly on what people with pain do as opposed to what people in pain feel. So, One of the things that I study is the psychology of pain behavior, or basically the psychology of what people do differently when they're experiencing pain. So on this slide here, you can assume, for those of you who are Star Trek enthusiasts, this is Captain Pike being tortured by the Talosians. And if you assume that he is really in pain, certainly there's all sorts of nociceptive stuff that's happening in his central nervous system and things firing about and making him feel in pain and in some distress. But he's also behaving in a way that's very different than the way he behaves when he's not in pain. And one of the things that's been, questions that have been really of central interest in our laboratory are what are some of the factors that play a role in how people behave when they're in pain. And one of the behaviors that I'm going to be focusing on today is the behavior of discontinuing employment. So that what happens to some people who are experiencing pain is that some of them will discontinue their employment, and I try to understand what is the psychology of that. Now, you might assume intuitively that if someone's in pain and they stop working, that the reason that they're stopping working is because their pain is sufficiently severe that it prevents them from working. Well, if that was the case, if pain severity could explain occupational disability, it'd be really tough making a career studying the psychology of that, right? But lucky for me is that that's not the situation. Research suggests that pain severity accounts for only 10% of the variance in occupational disability. So that if you want to know why someone who has a pain condition is not working, their pain story is only going to be 10% of the disability story. And so there's 90% of the factors contributing to occupational disability that are either only indirectly or not at all related to pain. And so this is where we've tried to understand or ask the question, do psychological factors play a role in that? Now, in spite of the fact that research suggests that only 10% of the variance in occupational disability can be accounted for by the severity of someone's pain symptoms, we continue to spend about 80% of our treatment-related resources on the management of pain symptoms. And we're going to try to do everything we possibly can to diagnose that pain, to give it a name, and then we're going to try to do everything that we can to try to make it go away. And we're going to inject that pain, and we're going to heat it up, we're going to cool it down, we're going to exercise it. Every now and then we're going to stick a psychologist next to it, but we are convinced that that pain has to disappear before that person can resume occupational activities. Well, if we believe that, chances are our patient or client is going to believe that as well.
High five. Shifting furniture friend, and just my back just was a bit sore afterwards, and sort of progressed over a few days of just being a bit sore, and ended up going to see the GP and had some physio, which sort of helped, but then the pain seemed to start spreading. I started getting pains down my left leg, which sort of continued, more physio, lots of anti-inflammatories, other pain things, but nothing. It just seemed to get to a certain stage and then just be triggered again. Ended up seeing an orthopedic specialist to get an MRI, which sort of didn't really show anything. More physio. Then it was suggested for a second opinion from another orthopedic guy who suggested it was just going to take time and fitness. And it still just continued, and I had pains down the leg, pain all the time. And then we had another opinion and another MRI, a higher one, which showed some thoracic discs out but wasn't really considered much. That stage the orthopaedic student made noises about surgery but wasn't keen and referred me on to a neurosurgeon for another opinion, and he suggested I suffered from chronic pain. I now had an injury that was chronic pain. So that had been all over about close to 18 months, I suppose it was.
So we keep this person out of work for 18 months so that at the end of it, we can tell her that she's got chronic pain. Okay? Statistics suggest that you keep someone out of work for 18 months, there's less than a 1% chance that that person will ever go back to work. Okay? This is not an uncommon story, and it could be argued that we, as the healthcare system, created that disability. This individual did not have to end up like this. And our research suggests that perhaps if we had considered psychosocial factors earlier on and intervened using different approaches, that the outcome might have been very different for this lady. One of the things that we also know is that if you take someone who has a pain condition, is not working, you give them pain medication, it's not going to get them back to work. And one of the things that really struck me when I first began working in this area is I was working in a rehabilitation center, and where we had a lot of people with persistent pain conditions that were often the result either of work-related accidents or motor vehicle accidents, soft tissue types of injuries that ended up turning into persistent pain. And so we put people through rehabilitation programs, and at the end of the rehabilitation program, some people go back to work and some people don't go back to work. I was curious early on about the difference in people's pain ratings for the ones who would go back to work and those who didn't go back to work. And I was really surprised to find out that there was no difference. There was no difference. And that basically when people were leaving rehab, it wasn't going to be the severity of their pain that was going to determine whether or not they would go back to work. And it's not just innocuous, our persistent efforts to try to make something go away that's not going to go away. There's some research that suggests that actually some of our pain-focused or symptom-focused interventions actually increase disability. And there's a number of research studies that have shown that prescribing someone an opiate within 4 weeks of the onset of a musculoskeletal condition increases by 1,400% the chances that they will never go back to work. Okay, So what are some of the psychosocial factors that might be playing a role in disability? I'm going to take you through a quick little excursion through some of the work that we've been doing, and then I'm going to talk about how what we've tried to do is take what we learned in the laboratory about psychological factors that can impact on pain experience and pain-related disability, and see if we can craft an intervention program that will be designed to specifically target some of those psychosocial factors. So catastrophic thinking is one of the psychological variables that we've been studying extensively over the years, and as captured by this illustration here, we're talking about individuals who have a tendency to be very alarmist about their pain symptoms. They're very alarmist about their pain symptoms, they focus their attention excessively on their pain symptoms, and they kind of believe that there's nothing that can be done to make their pain go away.
Well, I didn't want to say nothing, but I got this twinge in my neck, and when I turn my head like this, look, ow, see?
Who's hungry? I'll find us some dinner.
I'll get the firewood.
Hey, where are you going? Oh, man, I can't feel my toes. I don't have any toes. I think I need a hug.
So if this donkey reminds you of someone that you know, a family member, a friend, or very likely that that individual would have obtained a high score on a measure of catastrophic thinking related to pain. I'm going to show you a couple of video clips from individuals in our lab that we expose to painful situations, and we'll take a look at the different reactions of someone who is high or low on pain catastrophizing. This first video here is for an individual who is low on pain catastrophizing. So he's got his arm in what we refer to as a cold presser. It's basically a container of very cold water. The water is maintained at about 2 degrees centigrade. And it's about the most painful thing that you're allowed to do to someone in the lab without leaving permanent marks on them. And the research ethics committees here at McGill are very strict about leaving permanent marks on our participants. But what happens when you're in a cold presser is that first the temperature receptors on your skin tell you that this is cold and it's getting colder. And at some point, since the character of the sensation changes from a character of temperature to one of pain, because you're in pain, your blood pressure is going to go up. Because it's cold water, you have vasoconstriction of the vasculature near the surface of the skin, and it starts to create this kind of deep, kind of burning, aching pain that increases in intensity for about 90 seconds, and then you can't feel your arm after that. So anyway, what we do is that we ask people to put their arm in there, and then we ask them to give us pain ratings at 20-second intervals over time. And so that's what this individual was doing. He had his arm in a cold presser, and he's going to tell us how much pain he's experiencing. And this individual here actually tells us that it feels like a 4 on 10 on a 0 to 10 scale. This is an individual with a low score on a measure of catastrophic thinking. I'm going to show you a person going through the same experience who has a high score on a measure of catastrophic thinking. The Same person 20 seconds later. It's not a high empathy crowd here. Okay, he rates his pain as a 9 on 10 going through this experience, okay? With 10 being the worst pain imaginable. Okay, so you see that people who differ in this psychological characteristic are going to be responding to pain in very, very different ways. And for those of you who work in a health-related profession, if you imagine that both of these individuals are going to have, let's say, a motor vehicle accident on the way home and have a whiplash injury, who do you think you're still going to be treating 2 years from now? It'll probably be that second individual. And that's why we consider these factors to be risk factors for problematic recovery. Knowledge of a person's level of catastrophic thinking, even before an injury or pain experience, can allow us to predict their trajectory of recovery. And people with high levels of catastrophic thinking have a much longer and more complicated trajectory of recovery than people who have low scores on measures of catastrophic thinking. When you show this to non-academic audiences, they say, why doesn't he just take his arm out? So because he's a student, and we told him to put his arm in there, and he's going to leave it there until we tell him to take it out. That's just the way students are, man. So this is now a person with a low back pain problem, and she's lifting some weighted canisters here. And we're going to ask her to tell us how much they weigh. And we use this task to try to understand pain communication. If you have a low back pain condition, you're performing this task, especially when you're reaching for some of the canisters that are further away from the body, is that the postural positions that you need to assume are going to be increasing the loading on the lumbar portion of your spine, and it's going to make your pain a bit worse. And so it's like a pain induction procedure for someone who already has pain. We're interested in how people communicate their pain. So this is a person who's low on pain catastrophizing. She lifted a canister there and estimated the weight. She's going to do the task again, lifting these different canisters, but now we're going to ask her to tell us how much it hurts. And so on a scale from 0 to 10, she tells us it's a 3 demi in French or a 3.5 on 10. Which, interestingly, only women do that, eh? You ask for a number between 0 and 10, women give you fractions, eh? We've done this with hundreds and hundreds of patients, eh? I've never had a man give a fraction when he asks for a 0 to 10. I think it might be because women experience their world with a higher degree of precision than men do, perhaps, okay? So this is a person with a low score on a measure of pain catastrophizing. We don't see a whole lot in terms of pain communication. Now this individual here is a person with a high score on pain catastrophizing. He lifts the canister there with the instructions to estimate the weight. He's going to go on, do the task again. He comes around to the same canister. We ask him now to tell us how much it hurts on a scale from 0 to 10 when he lifts the canister. He lifts the canister and puts it down. And then he does this for us, okay? Now, what's interesting is that he did none of this the entire time that he was lifting the canisters and estimating the weight, but he does this after every single lift when he's rating his pain. So just changing the communication goals of the task give rise to a display of distress and disability in this individual that were not apparent at all when the person was doing exactly the same task, but with a different instructional set. And sometimes the difference is quite marked, where this individual here, again, someone with a high score in catastrophizing, she lifts the canister with the instructions to estimate the weight. She's going to do the task a second time, comes around to the same canister. We ask her, how much does it hurt? And she can't lift it anymore. And this we only see in high catastrophizers. So it becomes clear when you're watching these videos that certain psychological factors can play a big role in how people are going to be expressing their pain experience. And it also becomes apparent that it's very likely that some of these factors might be playing a role in the level of disability that the person is going to be experiencing. And so what might this look like in a real-life client interview situation?
You would not believe how much pain I have to endure every day. I was lucky today that I was able to make it here. And some days I can't even sit up for more than 15 minutes, and they're talking about me going back to work. What a joke. Would you hire me? No one would want me. What kind of treatment are you receiving?
So what's interesting here about our high catastrophizers, not only do our high catastrophizers display a lot of pain behavior, and so in that sense you might be wondering, well, would they be able to do their job? But if you were the employer, would you hire her? No. Okay? So her pain behavior also influences your judgments about her employability. And so catastrophizing has an impact not only on the manner in which it compromises people's physical performance, but it also influences observers' judgments about the degree to which that person is employable. So that's the story on catastrophizing. Fear of pain is also another psychological variable that's been closely linked to disability in individuals with persistent pain conditions. And you might be wondering, what does this slide have to do with that? This is actually an illustration of a treatment scene in a mental institution in the early 1800s. And in the early 1800s, we believed that pain was a good way, or was a good tool to use to try to control the behavior of some problematic patients. So what we have here is an interventionist, or a precursor to psychiatry, I guess, and he's got these metal bars in his hand that he has heated in hot coals, and with those metal bars, he's going to burn the faces of these young women. And we thought that that was a good thing in the early 1800s. Now, if you put yourself in the shoes of these young women, you'll probably find that your attention is completely fixated on the pain stimulus. The fear that you experience is probably going to be sufficiently intense as to immobilize you. And whatever you did that made this guy think that you needed this treatment is a behavior you're less likely to reproduce in the future. And if you understand that psychology, you can understand how fear can lead to disability in individuals with persistent pain conditions. For some individuals with persistent pain conditions, the fear that they experience is so intense that it immobilizes them, and any activity that's associated with an increase in their pain experience is an activity that they're going to be less likely to engage in the future. And the more activity that you discontinue or that you avoid, the more disabled you are. So, and the research on fear of pain and disability has almost cast disability as a phobic type of condition, because it suggests that any type of intervention that we can use to reduce fear might also be effective in reducing disability in individuals. And one of the things that we know about the reductions in fear is that repeated exposure is probably the most effective tool that we have to reduce someone's fear. So that if you're afraid of dogs, is that the best thing that I can do for you to reduce your fear of dogs is to expose you repeatedly to dogs. And I'm going to hope that the dog doesn't bite you during those exposures, because if the dog bites you, then it's not going to work. So, and we're going to come back to that in a minute. Those of you who work in the area of health have probably come across situations that during treatment or rehabilitation, your client was doing just fine, until someone says to your client, "Mr. Smith, I don't think you'll ever be able to go back to work." And at that point, all progress in treatment stops, because at that moment, the belief that's created in your client is that I am totally and permanently disabled. And the thing about beliefs is that they guide human behavior. If I was able to look inside your head and look at all the beliefs that you have, I would be able to predict your behavior in any life situation. So if you believe in Santa Claus, the night before Christmas, you might leave milk and cookies beside the fireplace in case the big guy comes to visit. If you don't believe in Santa Claus, you're not going to do that. So your beliefs guide your behavior. If you believe that you are totally disabled, you're going to behave in a way that is consistent with that belief, regardless of your underlying symptoms. And these beliefs are easy to create. It takes less than 5 seconds to be created. It takes a lot more work to try to change it once it has been established. But for our individuals who believe that they are totally disabled, is that for them, the idea of returning to work is not a feasible objective. And if something's not a feasible objective, you're not even going to be motivated to try for it. So disability beliefs are other psychosocial risk factors that have been shown to impact on a pain-related disability. And the only other psychosocial risk factor I'm going to talk about is perceived injustice. And we became interested in perceptions of injustice following injury after we were going through some of the files of clients that had gone through our center. And we were interested in clients who were using a language like, "Nothing will ever make up for what I've gone through." And what was interesting about that language is that people who spoke like that didn't get better. And as we reflected on what was the theme or what seemed to be the essence of that communication, we came to the conclusion that this was a language about perceptions of injustice, that the client felt that either the injury occurred under unjust situations or some of the procedures that were put in place after the injury were unjust or unfair. I'm just going to show you a little clip of an interview with someone who's experiencing a significant degree of perceptions of injustice associated with his injury.
"I told my boss 100 times that ramp wasn't safe. No one listened to me, and then it broke. You know, the ramp broke, the trolley goes backwards, and I'm pinned to one of the pillars. Now my back is wrecked. I'm telling you, I'm not planning on being back to work for a really long time."
Okay, so it's clear that he's in a situation where he sustains significant loss as a function of his injury. He finds or considers his employer to be the person responsible, the person to blame for his condition. And when he says, I'm not planning to be back at work for a long time, is he making a prediction there about his recovery path? Or is this some kind of retribution that he's thinking of? Okay? In the sense that as soon as you experience a situation as unjust, your mind automatically starts thinking about retribution or revenge. For those of you who are divorced, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And so, if you're a person who is now mentally at war with your employer, what power do you have in that war? Your disability is the only power that you have. As soon as you get better, you've lost the war. And so if perceptions of injustice are central to your experience, if retribution is what you're after, you can't let your disability go. So those are some of the psychosocial risk factors that research has suggested to us are very powerful predictors of a person's recovery path following injury. So one of the things that we learned in our research is that not only are these important predictors of problematic outcomes associated with injury, but they're also very intercorrelated. So people who have one of these are very likely to have all of them, which suggested to us that if you're going to be intervening, you're going to need to use intervention techniques that are simultaneously targeting all of these different factors. So that's what we set out to do next, was to try to build an intervention program that could help reduce the disability associated with persistent pain conditions. And the research in this area was telling us that these psychosocial risk factors can account for as much as 30% of the variance in pain-related disability, which suggested that if you can reduce these, that you might also be able to reduce the disability that's associated with pain. So what we did to build this intervention program is at first we just looked at the literature and said, well, what do we know about these risk factors and what has research told us about techniques that might help reduce either the presence of the psychosocial risk factor or at least its negative impact. And research suggested that education and reassurance were important intervention techniques for the person who has a tendency to be very alarmist about his or her pain symptoms. Research also told us that disclosure, because you saw that in the pain lifting paradigm, is that just variations in the communication goals of the task seem to play a role in how people are going to be expressing their pain and disability. The research suggested that disclosure techniques or communication-like techniques were important in reducing the distress of the high catastrophizer. We've known for a long time that validation techniques are important for reducing a person's sense of perceived injustice or a sense of unfairness. Research in cognitive behavioral interventions has told us that thought monitoring or reappraisal types of techniques can be important in reducing the frequency of negative thoughts, catastrophic thoughts, or perceived injustice thoughts that might be having a negative impact on your recovery. As I mentioned, exposure interventions are the most effective way of reducing fears, and so we thought maybe activity exposure would be one of the ways in which we could start targeting fears associated with different types of activities. And you cannot, once a person believes something, like if you believe that you're totally disabled, and I believe that you can do more than what you're doing, I'm not going to be able to talk you out of your beliefs. Because the thing about the human condition is that human beings like to protect their beliefs. And whenever we try to change someone's beliefs, people actually defend their beliefs rather than change their beliefs. So we know that you're not going to be able to talk people out of their beliefs. What you can do, however, is try to get people to behave their way out of beliefs. And for those of you who are parents, probably an example of this would be at some point when you were raising your children and you thought it would be good for my child to develop some beliefs about positive dental hygiene, you know, like brushing your teeth regularly. And chances are the approach that you use was not saying, listen, Mary, there's this thing called gingivitis and it starts to attack tissues of your mouth and puts you at high risk for periodontal disease, bad scene altogether. So if you try to brush your teeth every day, it'd be good thing. That's probably not what happened. Or if it did, it probably wasn't effective. What probably happened was that it was you, Mary, and the toothbrush, and you said, Mary, this is the situation. There's you, me, and the toothbrush. No one's getting out of here until you brush your teeth, okay? So what you've done is that you've taken control of behavior, and you're going to do that repeatedly, and eventually Mary's going to develop beliefs about positive dental hygiene, okay? And so that's what we're going to try to do in our intervention as well. We're going to try to get people to behave their way out of their disability beliefs. And we're going to take all of these intervention techniques and package them within the context of a life role reintegration program, one of the objectives of which is going to be to assist the person in returning to work. So the program that emerged out of all this work is referred to as the Progressive Goal Attainment Program. And it's essentially a skill set so that we train interventionists in rehabilitation to be providers of this intervention. So it's an intervention that's delivered by one individual. And so people who are working in the area of rehabilitation would sign up for one of our workshops, and they would attend a two-day workshop where we would be trying to train them in a whole set of skills that belong to the different categories that I just described. And it's a standardized intervention such that everybody that comes into the intervention gets about the same thing. And so there's a treatment manual that describes all the techniques of the intervention program, and there's a client workbook, and I'm going to show bits of that in a minute, that we use as a platform for the delivery of a lot of the intervention techniques. And then there's a video that we use to convince the client to participate in the intervention program. So the first thing that happens is that we're going to screen you. So if you were clients that were being considered for this intervention program, and if I look at the age distribution in this classroom, there's at least 20% of you that probably have a persistent pain condition. And if you're not working, and if you would like to go back to work, we would screen you on these different psychosocial risk factors. And the first thing that we're interested in is whether you have elevated scores on them. Because since our intervention program is going to be designed to try to reduce these psychosocial risk factors, it only makes sense to invite people into the intervention program who have problems in these areas. So that we're not saying that psychosocial factors explain all of disability that's associated with pain. We're saying that for individuals who have elevated scores on these psychosocial risk factors, our intervention might be useful in reducing their level of disability. So if you obtain an elevated score on at least one of these psychosocial risk factors, we would consider you a suitable candidate for the intervention. The next step is that we have to convince you to participate in the intervention. And from some of the other talks that you've had, a lot of the themes that weave through talks on pain are different ways of relieving people's pain. Well, the bottom line, really, for a lot of people with particularly with musculoskeletal conditions, there is nothing that's going to take their pain away. Today, we know of no intervention that alters the natural history of a musculoskeletal condition. So that these are conditions that people are going to be experiencing throughout most of their lives. They'll wax and wane in severity through their lives, but they will never be cured of that condition. Okay? However, if I was going to open up a clinic downtown and say, you know, in our new clinic, we got this brand new treatment, it's going to cure you of your pain. People are going to line up for that, right? But if I say, got a brand new clinic downtown Montreal, we're going to help you get back to work. No one's lining up, okay? So one of the things that we know in rehabilitation is that you have to convince the client that this is something they want to participate in. Injury insurers tell us that anywhere between 40 to 70% of people refuse referrals to rehabilitation treatment. And again, it's just rehabilitation is not an attractive treatment option, you know? People don't want to be rehabilitated. People want to be cured, you know? So if you want to get people in your intervention program, you're going to have to do some work to engage that client. So we developed this video, which is like our commercial for our PGAP program, and that's the first thing that we're going to be doing when we meet our client. We're going to say, you know, it's like our assessment suggests there's an intervention here that we believe would be helpful for you, and there's a video that describes the intervention. I would like to watch that video with you. And we built the video in exactly the way that people who are trying to sell you stuff on television put their commercials together. We built it in a way that was designed to convince people, or to make our treatment option more attractive to them. And so why use a video? Well, there's a lot of reasons why you want to use videos. That multimedia is more engaging. It can be repeated many times, especially if this is important information. We know that people forget 80% of what clinicians tell them. Well, if I have an important message, I don't want you to forget it. So if I put in video, you can take it home and watch it over again to maximize the probability it's going to be retained. You can watch it with significant others at home so that everybody knows what it is that we're going to be doing with you. And it's standardized, which is good from a research perspective. So what do I want to put in this video? I'm not going to show you the whole thing. I'm just going to show you bits and pieces of it. Well, if my video is going to be, or if my intervention program is designed to help you reintegrate into activity domains that have been discontinued, I want you to understand the negative consequences of inactivity. I want you to know that that's bad. Okay, so we have a narrator that's going to be talking about the negative consequences of inactivity.
In the past, we've tried to treat pain conditions by getting people to rest and remain inactive. We told them to stop working, to rest, and to avoid activities that made the pain worse. But it soon became clear that activity reduction was not the best way to proceed in treating pain conditions. We now know that reducing activity might be the worst thing to do in the treatment of a pain condition. Pain conditions have the best chance of recovery if we remain as active as we possibly can.
So you, as the skeptical client at this point, are going, who is she? What does she know about my condition? Is that we also know that as a pain client, you think that there's going to be some voices that are more credible than others, and medical voices are going to be more credible voices. So within the video, we also have interviews with physicians that deliver the same kind of message. And the message is that the physicians deliver is that individuals need to be challenged in order to recover, that there's no curative process that occurs at home, and that you can return to work even if your symptoms persist.
The soft tissue injuries is one that emphasizes early return to the workplace, much like with athletics. We would never put somebody on the sidelines for an extended period of time because they decondition so badly that you just never get them back to that environment, whether it's skating or whether it's working on the assembly line. So the current approach is to take the tissue that is hurt, modify the activity, but keep the tissue healed, or keep the tissue challenged, because that's how it heals best. And we've studied that and we know that, and Hippocrates emphasized that.
So one of them is that inactivity is only going to make your condition worse, and that you actually need to challenge tissues in order to kick in repair mechanisms.
The physician has to always ask the question, what exactly is it about being at home that will cure this condition?
There's no curative process at home.
Most employers these days are quite anxious to take people back to work and get them involved in their work mode, and so they'll soon be able to go back to the type of work they did before. So again, it's when you're up and you're active, you do not have to be pain-free to go back to work.
And again, that's an important message. You don't have to be pain-free to go back to work, especially for individuals who are going to have this condition for pretty much the rest of their lives. So what else do we want our client to understand? We want our client to understand that this is not a pain management program. This is a program that's going to help them get back to work. So we want to make sure that return to work is the stated objective of our intervention.
This is really what PGAP is all about. It's about helping people get their life back. Even though medical science might not be able to cure your health condition, there might still be things we could do to help you get the most out of your life, even though some of your symptoms still persist. One of the main objectives of PGAP is to help you return to work. This may mean returning to your previous employment, or if that's not possible, preparing you for a different type of employment. By the time you complete the 10-week program, you, your PGAP clinician, and your physician will have a clearer picture of the types of activities you are able to perform and the types of activities you are not able to perform. If your condition prevents you from returning to work, involvement in PGAP can still be helpful in contributing to your quality of life. After all, it is through our social, recreational, and community activities that we derive our sense of who we are and what our life is all about. Thank you for taking the time to view this video. We hope that you've learned a bit more about your pain condition and how PGAP can help you resume the activities that have brought a sense of purpose and meaning to your life. If you have any questions about PGAP or would like to discuss further your participation in the program, please ask your PGAP clinician.
Then the video ends, and then I would turn to you, the client, and say, so, are you interested in participating in this program? And then you would say, no, no. It says nothing about taking my pain away, so I'm not interested at all. And we anticipate that you're going to say this, and so we prepare our clinicians with all these additional engagement techniques to maximize the probability that we're going to engage the client that was not convinced by the video presentation. And we might say to you, say, okay, I understand that you're not convinced that this is something that can be helpful, but I'm convinced that this is something that can help you. And I'm going to ask you to give me 2 weeks. Work with me for 2 weeks, and I guarantee that we're going to make some positive changes. And if after 2 weeks you're not convinced, we can stop. And essentially what I'm doing here is that I'm using a technique that used car salesmen use, where they propose a price to you that you turn down, and then they slash the price down to a fraction of what it was, and you'd almost seem unreasonable saying no. So our narrator proposed this as a 10-week intervention program. I'm now saying 2 weeks. Who wouldn't give me 2 weeks, okay? And you might be thinking to yourself, well, what are you going to do in 2 weeks that's going to make a difference? Well, at the front end of the intervention program, all of our techniques are geared towards maximizing the probability that we're going to be developing a strong working alliance with the client. Stated in English, that means I'm going to get you to like me in 2 weeks. That's my primary objective. And one of the things that we know about human beings is that once you like someone, the last thing that you want to do is do something that is going to make them look disappointed. Okay? And if you know that I want you to stay in this program, and now you like me, you're not going to want to disappoint me. And so what we do is that we start using the relationship that we build with a client as a tool to motivate the client in the intervention program. So then finally you say, okay, I'll try it. So what happens next? So then at the beginning of the intervention program, so I'm going to be meeting with you for 1 hour a week for a maximum of 10 weeks. So we're going to be meeting weekly. At the front end of the program, we're going to be working on developing the working relationship because I'm going to need that relationship to help drive the intervention forward. I'm going to be introducing you to the client workbook and how we're going to use it in the intervention program. And then we're going to start using a lot of techniques geared towards increasing the structure of activity that's occurring in your day-to-day life. And I'll get back to that in a moment. And we're going to be using different types of techniques that are going to be targeting the psychosocial risk factors that we talked about. Now, one of the things that we've done in this intervention program is because no one wants to think of their disability as being caused by psychological factors. At no point is the client told that this is a psychological intervention. And all the words that I use, like catastrophic thinking, fear, disability, beliefs, perceived injustice, we are never going to use that language with our clients. Okay? Well, what are we going to do? Well, in the first week of the intervention program, I'm going to be asking my client just to log the activities that they do during the course of the week. And so if the client says, well, what are you going to ask me to do? I say, well, in this client workbook, you see here it says week one, day one to day five. What I'd like you to do for the next 5 days is just write down all the activities that you do during the day. It's going to give me a better sense of how your pain condition has affected your life. And so this is often what we're going to be seeing with our clients in the first week is that they're living a very sedentary lifestyle. And so that for a lot of pain clients, there's a bit of a flurry of activity around mealtime and a whole lot of downtime during the rest of the day. Now, this goes on for any significant amount of time. You're going to have a person that's very physically deconditioned that's actually going to make their pain symptoms worse. And from a psychological perspective, this person's going to be heading down a very dark road because everything that this human psyche needs to stay healthy, like social contact, like success and achievement experiences, are not part of this person's life. So certainly we know that if this characterizes the individual's life, we need to bring changes to this. In the second week of the intervention program, the format of the client workbook changes so that now I'm not going to be asking my client just to log activities. I'm going to be working with my client to plan activities. And the first thing that I'm going to be working on planning with my client is getting my client to wake up at the same time that he or she used to wake up at when he or she was working, go through the same morning routine that he or she went through when he or she was working, and at the time that the client would have left to go to work, I'm going to ask my client to take a 15-minute walk. Okay. So what I've done here is that I've just started to put back in place the activity structure that existed when my client was working. Okay. And this is my first step in getting my client to start behaving like a person that is working. So what I'm trying to do is start to engineer a situation that is going to alter my client's behavior so that it resembles more and more the behavior of a person who is working. Because if we think back to the original slide back there, is that my client's disability beliefs are reinforced every day because my client behaves like a disabled person. And I want to try starting to change that. I'm going to get my client to behave more and more like a person that is working. And during the second week, the only other thing I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce one new activity and let my client choose that activity. So I say, I want you to try to do something that you haven't done in a while, but something, let's say, that needs to be done around the house, or something that you've been thinking of doing, something that you enjoy doing. And then the client might say, well, the garage is a mess, and I should probably get around to try to clean that up. And so he might suggest sweeping the garage as one of the activities. And I ask my client, how long do you think you could do that before you would pay the price for it tomorrow? Because I know that an individual with a pain condition is at some point going to reach his or her tolerance limits, and that might yield an exacerbation in pain symptoms. And if my client says, I could probably do that for 30 minutes, I'm going to say, fine, we're going to do it for 15 minutes, and we're going to do it every day. So I'm going to pick a duration of that activity that's well within my client's tolerance limits, and I'm going to expose my client to that activity repeatedly through the week. I'm essentially using activity exposure to try to reduce the fear that my client experiences in relation to that activity. And the reason that I want to stay well within my client's tolerance limits is that I don't want to risk having a symptom exacerbation. In the same way that if I expose you to dogs and the dog bites you, it's not going to reduce your fear. Well, the pain going up is the same as the dog biting you. So I want to make sure that my client participates in the activity without the negative anticipated consequences. And one of the things that I know about fear as well is that fear is actually amplifying my client's level of pain. And if I can reduce the fear, then the intensity of pain is actually going to go down as well, permitting my client to participate in larger and larger amounts of that activity. And we're going to progress like this through the intervention program, increasing the number of activities that we're engaging our client to, and at some point we're going to have a client going through the day behaving like a person who is working. And at that point, it's going to be a lot easier for my client to consider a transition back to the workplace. So one of the things that I'm doing here is that even though psychosocial variables are my targets, I'm using activity strategically to change how my client is thinking. Rather than talking my client out of his or her psychosocial factors, I'm getting my client to behave his or her way out of his or her psychosocial factors. And using activity to change how people think is not something that's new. For those of you who, let's say, ever enrolled one of your children in soccer because you thought that soccer was going to be a good activity for your client to learn about responsibility and teamwork and camaraderie, well, those are all psychosocial objectives, even though a soccer coach would never have perceived himself as being a psychosocial interventionist. You can use activity to change how people think, and that's what we do in PGAP. We try to use activity to change how people think. So the intervention, it will span a maximum of 10 weeks, and I say maximum 10 weeks because it doesn't have to be 10 weeks because the goal of the intervention is to help people return to work, and if that happens before 10 weeks, then the intervention ends before 10 weeks. But it never goes beyond 10 weeks. If it doesn't work in 10 weeks, it's not going to work in 20 weeks. And this is important in the area of psychosocial interventions, where there's been a tendency in the past for psychosocial interventions to go on forever. And really, you know, it's like I think we do a disservice to everybody when we let that happen, because as interventionists, we need to know the limits of our tools. And if our tools tell us that really, you know, the major impact of these kinds of intervention tools happens fairly quickly, then it doesn't make sense to go on for months and months and months in these. If the tool doesn't work, at one point you're doing everybody a favor by stopping using it. So at the beginning, we're going to have individuals that they're going to be logging activities for us. We start activity planning with the individual. And for many clients with musculoskeletal injuries, by week 5, they're now proceeding through a day with their involvement in a significant amount of activities that have been previously discontinued. And those check marks are the check marks that the individual basically puts there to indicate that the activity was successfully completed. And one of the things that I think that we do that ends up being a major ingredient of change in this intervention program is that each one of those check marks is a success and achievement experience, and the human psyche needs that in order to stay healthy. You need to see yourself as an effective human being as you go through your day-to-day life, and the less that you feel as an effective human being in your day-to-day life, the more at risk you're going to be for the development of mental health symptoms. At week 4 of the intervention, we reassess all our psychosocial risk factors, and what we're hoping to see is a significant reduction in the different psychosocial risk factors. And for a client who, let's say, at week 5 has got a full activity schedule and our mid-treatment assessments suggest that there's reductions in all psychosocial risk factors, there's no need to keep going on with this client. With that client, we would be broaching the idea of talking to someone about putting together a modified return-to-work program for that individual. So for many of our clients, often PGAP is going to terminate at week 5. So, does this kind of thing work? Of course it does. PGAP has probably been one of the most researched psychosocial interventions to date, and it's been studied in a number of different contexts using a number of different providers, so that people who have been trained as PGAP providers have been occupational therapists, physical therapists, occupational health nurses, psychologists. And for us, when we're training individuals, it's not so much the intervention discipline that's important, is that the person have a good understanding of the condition that they're working on as a rehabilitation service provider. So those are some of the different studies that have been published over the years on the effectiveness of PGAP. And I'm just going to show you some of the results of a study we recently completed. These were with clients of the CSST. And so they're individuals that had musculoskeletal injuries that were sustained in the workplace. It says up there that they're subacute work disabled. Subacute is a language that's used in this area to refer to individuals that are within about 4 to 12 weeks of injury when they're enrolled in an intervention program. So these are fairly recent onset injuries. And in this trial, what we did is that we compared individuals who were enrolled in a physical therapy program to individuals who were receiving the same physical therapy program, but with the addition of PGAP. The question we're asking, does the addition of PGAP make any difference? And so in terms of ongoing pain medications, we see that providing PGAP reduces by about 50% the pain medications that people are taking. And these are one-year follow-up data. so 1 year after the intervention was completed. In terms of requiring additional treatment, again, we see a significant reduction in the use of ongoing treatment by the people who receive PGAP. In terms of ongoing pain, absolutely no difference. And again, what I was saying is, like, for a lot of people with musculoskeletal conditions, they're always going to have those musculoskeletal conditions. And so the physical therapy doesn't cure that, and PGAP doesn't cure it either. And so these people continue to have pain symptoms in spite of that, is that participation in PGAP increases by about 40% the probability that people return to work. And so research like this suggests that an intervention that is going to do nothing for your pain symptoms, but is going to try to reduce some of your psychosocial barriers to activity involvement, can be an effective tool for facilitating return to work. And this is these are data from a trial we conducted with individuals who had whiplash symptoms. And in this slide, we do is that we broke down the our client sample into subgroups depending on the number of risk factors where individuals had elevated scores. So one here, individuals had an elevated score and only one psychosocial risk factor, and four is for individuals who had elevated scores on all four psychosocial risk factors. And so in red, we see the PGAP group, in yellow, the physio group, and we see that there's a slight advantage of PGAP for individuals that have one or two psychosocial risk factors, but really you see the biggest difference for individuals that have elevations on all four psychosocial risk factors, where the inclusion of PGAP more than doubles the probability of return to work in that sample. And we've also used PGAP for individuals with much more chronic conditions. So this was a study that we did with individuals that had either chronic musculoskeletal problems or fibromyalgia. And I think this is one of the first trials that actually showed a return-to-work effect for individuals with fibromyalgia. It's almost as if we decide in rehabilitation that that's not even a feasible goal for that population. And if you look at the kinds of interventions that are offered for individuals with fibromyalgia in rehabilitation centers, return to work is never on the table as an objective for those individuals. And in our study, we showed that actually it is possible to return at least some of these individuals back to work. Now, for the more chronic cases, you always see a reduced probability of return to work, because there's a number of other issues that are going to be playing a role here, is that the longer that the person's been out of the workplace, the more challenging it is going to be to get that person reintegrated into the workplace, even though they might be very willing to do so. And so our return-to-work rates are much more modest for chronic cases than they are for individuals with recent onset conditions. So then a number of years ago, about 5 years ago, the Social Security Administration in the United States, which is very similar to our Canada Pension. So if you get, like, very sick and you can't work anymore, you would go on Canada Pension and you would receive some kind of financial subsidy to keep you alive. And so when the Social Security Administration does that in the U.S., and their situation in the U.S. is that they have 160,000 new cases go on disability insurance every year. No one goes off without dying. And so people stay on for the rest of their life, and this is a very expensive thing for them. So they approached us and they said, this PGAP program of yours, do you think that you could use it on our disability insurance population? I went, I don't know, man. Because if your guys are like our Canada Pension people, I was like, these are people that are very sick, and often the disconnection with the workplace has been very long-standing. And they said, not only that, we want you to do it by telephone. Because there's no way we could train providers all the way through the U.S. So we said, actually, we've been using a telephonic version of the PGAP program as well, because in Canada what happens is that we have a lot of people that live in rural and remote areas that we're never going to have specialized services. So yes, we have a telephonic version, but I'm not sure that this is going to make much of a difference here. And telephonic version of PGAP works pretty much exactly the same way as the face-to-face version, except that you would receive a phone call from someone who says, hey, you know, hi. We have this great program here that we would like to interest you in, and we have a video that describes it. We'd like to send you the video. You can watch it, and I'll call you back next week. So you get the video, you watch it, and I call you back and say, so, are you interested? And you say, absolutely not. And you go, come on, give me 2 weeks. Work with me for 2 weeks, and I guarantee we can make some differences. And if I say, okay, I'll give you 2 weeks. And I say, okay, I'm going to send you a client workbook. And then, so you get your client workbook, and me as the interventionist, I have a customized software platform where I'm going to be working with you to develop these activity schedules, and all of our contacts are going to be over the phone over time. And our research suggests that PGAP by telephone worked okay, but not as good as face-to-face, because you just never develop the same relationship with someone that you can see than someone that's only on the phone. And it's also, it's a lot easier to avoid a phone call later when you're going, oh, it's a PDAP provider again. So our engagement's a bit more challenging than telephone. But in the end, we said, okay, we'll try this. And so in this trial, we trained a number of people in Indianapolis to be our PGAPTEL call center. These were individuals, they were health coaches. And the health coaches, it's an interesting concept. We don't have those here in Canada because the way they work is they're like health cheerleaders. So the way that they work in the U.S. is that if I'm an employer and I want to hire you and I want to give you, let's say, a health care policy as one of the benefits of working with me so that you're going to take the job, but once you've got this health care policy, I don't want you to use it because if you use it, my premiums go up, okay? And I don't want my premiums to go up, so I'm going to give it to you, but I don't want you to use it, so I hire these health coaches to call you every now and then to tell you, give you tips and tricks on how to stay healthy, you know, as I go for a walk, smile every day, those kinds of things. So that's who these people were. But we trained them to be PDAP providers for this trial. And one of the things that the SSA, or Social Security Administration, was interested in looking at was whether or not this kind of intervention could at least get some people back to work. With the idea being that, yes, all these people are very sick, but some of these people have conditions that wax and wane in severity over time, and maybe some people have gotten better enough that they might be able to consider return to work. And when we were first starting to work on this project, I was saying, you know, I was like, I wouldn't expect the kinds of outcomes that we get with recently injured people where, you know, I was like, we might be getting 50, 60% of people back to work. I said, I don't think it's going to happen with this population. And one of the numbers people from the SSA said, well, if we were going to roll this out hypothetically on a countrywide basis, you get 1% of these people back to work, we save $3 billion a year. Okay? So from their perspective, they were looking for a high rate of return to work to make it worthwhile. So basically in this trial, there's 2,000 participants that were randomized to one of three conditions, probably one of the largest rehabilitation trials that's ever been conducted. It was a $40 million trial. And fortunately, we didn't get the money here at McGill because it's in the U.S. But one of the things that they were doing is that they were comparing either a control arm where people got nothing, they just filled out questionnaires, one arm where people got health care. And again, from a Canadian perspective, this is a bit hard to wrap your head around, but most of these people don't have access to health care. So that in the U.S., it's actually possible to end up on disability insurance without ever having been treated for the condition for which you're disabled by. And in the U.S., the SSA doesn't want to give you Medicare right away after going on disability insurance because they're afraid that there's going to be too much of an incentive for people who don't have insurance to go on disability insurance. So you have to wait for 2 years before you have access to health care once you're on disability insurance. And they were explaining it to me like that. I'm going, wait, you just want more of these people to die to keep your numbers down? But anyway, that was a cynical part of me. And then the other condition, they got health care and they got PGAP. And I wish I could tell you the results of the trial, but we don't have the data. But I do know that it worked. But what happens is that since the data is not ours, we can't report on it. And whether or not it gets reported publicly is going to depend on whether or not it fits the health reform agenda of the government in the United States at the current time. So we may or may not hear. But it was a fascinating experience to work on a trial of this magnitude with the because again, it's as a laboratory researcher, we don't necessarily have the skill set sometimes to intervene on an entire country in this way, and so working with these groups in the United States was just a fabulous, fabulous learning experience for us. So to wrap things up, so the concepts, what have we been talking about? So we've been trying to understand some of the psychosocial factors that can impact on a person's involvement in important life role activities, and we try to develop an intervention program that's going to maximize individuals' involvement in their activities. And this is this thing about participation where I think it's just such a key is that, you know, even though, yes, we need to be doing whatever it is that we can to reduce the suffering of people in pain, is that when you talk to people in their final hours of their life and you ask them what were the most important things in their life, people don't talk about symptoms or medication. People talk about relationships and what they participated in life. And so I think that we need to keep that in mind, let's say, individuals' personal definitions of quality of life and make sure that our interventions are actually making a difference in the things that are going to be most important to our clients, to people, when they're reflecting on their life experience. So we also want it to be risk-targeted. We want an intervention that is going to basically be targeting the individuals for whom they have problems in the areas that are going to be addressed in the intervention. One of the things that we tried to do with PGAP, and by building it as a skill set, the idea being that if this was a training workshop and you were all interventionists that came from different parts of the province, after this workshop you go back to your community of residence and that intervention is now available to clients in your community of residence. So we wanted an intervention program that wasn't going to be sitting in one hospital or in one clinic, but one that could potentially exist in every community of residence in the country, thereby making the intervention most accessible. And as I mentioned, return to work is the primary objective. And you might be wondering, say, well, why is return to work such a big thing for this guy? Is that really, for a person who has a debilitating health or mental health condition, return to work is the highest level of independence you can offer them. And I believe that we should at least try for that. Now, having said that, we also know that, especially if we're intervening with people who are, let's say, on Social Security Administration or Canada Pension, most of our clients are not going to be going back to work because there's some realities of their health condition that is going to stop that from happening. And one of the last things that we want to do is to expose our client to another failure experience, because if their condition is chronic, by definition, they have failed at everything that's been offered so far. And that's why in PGAP, when we start working on reintegrating the person in life role activities, in the video, the activities that you see are social activities, community activities, essentially all sorts of activities that would increase a person's quality of life regardless of whether they ever went back to work. So we wanted to make sure that this was an intervention that would have the person in the direction of going back to work, but even if the person did not go back to work, that the person would not feel like they have failed in the intervention. So no one fails at the intervention program. So that's my story. So thanks for your attention.
We have a wonderful parting gift for Mick.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
And I'd ask our people to write out their questions. And Ingrid, who does most of the legwork organizing this, will, and our other volunteers will collect them. And then I will read them. And Mick will answer them. And we're off. Okay. Well, this one is truly remarkable handwriting. So, and I hope I pronounced it correctly. I'm always scared a little bit by reading something with multi-syllable words. Okay. So how does catastrophizing differ from somatoform pain disorder? I pronounced it wrong, right?
Yeah, so the question about the relationship between catastrophic thinking and somatoform disorders. And for those of you who aren't fluent in psychiatric taxonomy, in somatoform disorders, we're talking about individuals who have a psychological profile that seems to either exacerbate, enhance, or actually sometimes even give rise to physical symptoms that are difficult to understand from purely physiological perspective. And it's possible that there's an overlap between what is referred to as somatoform disorders and catastrophic thinking, except that there's been a lot more research that's been conducted on catastrophic thinking. So we can define that phenomena better, that we can link it to outcomes better, and in somatoform disorders, we have an intuitive sense of what that is, but there's very, very little mechanistic research that has been conducted there. And in the somatoform disorder, there's also the idea that the psychology somehow creates the condition. And we know that that's not the case in individuals who are high in catastrophic thinking. Individuals who are high in catastrophic thinking seems to amplify the distress of disability, not create it. And there's all sorts of research also that suggests that even though I talked about catastrophizing very much as a psychological type of phenomena, a lot of research suggests that it's got one foot firmly planted in physiology, so that there's research that suggests that let's say after a third molar extraction, catastrophizers have more inflamed tissues than non-catastrophizers, that catastrophizers respond less well to pain medication. We just completed a trial showing that high catastrophizers, if you look at them 2 years after joint replacement surgery, high catastrophizers show no difference in pain as a function of having the surgery. Non-catastrophizers show a 50% reduction in pain. And so there's a lot of things that that we understand about mechanisms of catastrophizing. I think it gives more confidence in talking about this condition than somatoform conditions.
Now here's a very beautifully written question. But this is a kind of a pointed question, although with a fair bit of tact. So, does financial compensation cloud the analysis of the psychosocial responses to pain?
So, the financial factors play a role in what it is that we're going to be understanding about pain phenomena. I would say yes and no, in the sense that one of the things that we know about the human condition is that if there's an incentive for, if there's going to be a payoff for you, let's say, presenting in a certain way, you might be motivated to present in that way, whether or not it's an authentic representation of your actual experience. In the laboratory, we try to get by all of that, so that basically there's very few financial incentives for someone on how someone's going to be responding in a laboratory pain research situation, so that, you know, it's like you get the same $15, whether it doesn't matter how you perform in the lab. When it comes to intervening, however, financial incentives are going to be playing a very significant role. So, for example, when we use our intervention programs with, let's say, workers' compensation clients where there's no litigation involved, then our outcomes are a whole lot better than when we are intervening with individuals who have sustained injuries in motor vehicle accidents, let's say outside of Quebec, where you might have a lawyer involved in litigating on your behalf. And in a situation where there's going to be a vested interest in you maintaining a high level of disability, any intervention program is going to have a more modest impact there.
And this from someone who I think is hoping that you've been introduced to the wonders of the World Wide Web. Have you tried using Skype with your clients instead of a telephone? And if you did, I'm sure you have, you know, but does that increase the likelihood of success?
So the question about using a teletechnology to assist in this kind of intervention, and as teletechnology becomes more and more accessible, one of the things that I think is paramount to any interventionist is going to see the degree to which you can make the best use of that as possible. In our telephonic interventions, one of the reasons that we use telephones is that people on disability insurance are so poor that one of the challenges was actually getting them, making sure they had a phone for the 10-week intervention. And so that the Skype would have not been an option that we could have entertained in that kind of a project. Even when we've tried to use things like Skype, is that unfortunately that technology is still a bit unreliable in the sense that, you know, it's like you're on the computer and all of a sudden the image starts breaking up and then you can't hear the sound or you get the sound without the picture. And all of those kinds of things really impact negatively on the momentum of a psychosocial intervention. And so I think that as the technology becomes, let's say, as we iron out the bugs in that technology more and more, it will become, I think, a bigger and bigger part of the types of interventions that we offer. And I think at some level there would be no difference between seeing someone's face on a computer and being face-to-face with the person in the same office.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And here are two related questions, and the first one I think was implicit in your presentation. So do to successful graduates of the program report being happier? And the second part of the question, well, it's really almost like a second question, has this type of program been translated into one to study individuals with other conditions, with chronic psychiatric conditions like chronic depression?
So I'll address the second part first. I only spoke about PGAP being used for pain conditions, but in the same way that in Canada Pension you can have people with a variety of debilitating health and mental health conditions. In the SSA trial, that was the case as well. So it was anybody who was on disability insurance that was invited to participate in the intervention program. And what that means is that we have different videos to try to engage the person with a mental health condition or person with a pain condition. And right now, we've just launched an intervention trial with the Veterans Administration in the U.S., where one of the big problems that that they're facing right now are vets coming back from combat areas suffering from post-traumatic stress conditions. And pretty much everything that has been tried so far with that population has had no impact whatsoever on the disability that's associated with PTSD. And so we've modified PGAP to basically target the disability associated with post-traumatic stress conditions in combat veterans. And we're just in the first year of that trial, but coming back to one of the other questions about, it's like, have we shown that this type of intervention increases quality of life? There's actually, from that trial, we found that this type of intervention actually saves lives. Well, we've had people say that actually participation in this program stopped them from killing themselves. And it's not that there's anything psychological that's going on here, but I think it's you start re-engaging people in activities that define their identity, and that has a whopping therapeutic effect. So.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. This this one's not directly related to your talk, but in any case, will people leaving work due to a disability influence others to do the same, perhaps causing them to fabricate a disability of their own?
Yeah, so let's say the lack of authenticity of presenting disability. And again, coming back to the financial incentive thing, is that the thing about the human condition is that human beings tend to be opportunistic. If you think that there's, it's like an extra cookie somewhere, you'll go looking for it. And but it represents such a small percentage of the disability problem that as researchers, we haven't been all that interested in studying it. And so I'd say, well, yes, there are opportunistic individuals out there. There are individuals that have probably tried to fabricate disabilities. But I would hesitate to characterize the disabled population in that way. So.
Is there any chance that the pain condition worsens during the program by doing more activities? And is the program of value for people that don't show one of these four risk factors for...
So the first part of the question, is there a problem of pain getting worse? Well, and here's where you have to in your mind separate pain symptoms getting worse from a pain condition getting worse. And for the most part, individuals with pain conditions don't have a condition that's going to get worse. But on a specific day, their pain symptoms might go up. But those pain symptoms don't indicate that the severity of the condition has now changed. And one of the things that we do is that we try as much as possible to stay within tolerance limits of the individual so that the individual doesn't experience those exacerbations and pain, or actually at least that they're minimized in their frequency. And it's impossible for us to predict right now which individuals are going to benefit from increased activity participation and the individuals for whom that's not going to make a difference. And all we can do is try the intervention. I think that's the only way, that we can distinguish between those two groups at this time. So, it's like my response often when individuals say, it's like, would it be worth trying PGAP on this kind of condition or that kind of condition? All I say is try it. Try it, and within a few weeks you'll know whether this is something that's helping or not. And if it's not helping, then consider something else.
Okay. This question, speaking of falsehood, I'm suspicious of this question, frankly, because of the quality of the handwriting, but I'll read it nevertheless the way it's written. Being a physician, how can I involve my patients in your program or a program like it, and are such programs covered by the RAMQ?
So if you're a physician, you have clients that you think might benefit from this type of intervention program, how would you refer someone to that kind of intervention program? There are some PGAP providers in Quebec, although not to the degree. Most of our work has been done in the U.S. so far, and it's only because we're not a service provider. We're just a research center. And so we've been working on this intervention primarily with large groups that are interested in testing the effectiveness of it. But coming back to your question, yes, there would be people that you could refer to. And these types of services, if the discipline of practice of the individual that's going to be offering the service is covered by the insurer, they will cover that service as well.
Okay, and as is traditional in many science, we have a question to split the audience down the middle. Is PGAP more successful with men versus women?
Well, I mean, it's the data suggest that that return to work rates are slightly lower for women than they are with men. But there's a number of reasons, I think, that are not necessarily related to the... This is something that's found across rehabilitation interventions. So it's not specific to PGAP, but it's issues related to often in our society the male of the family will still be the primary wage earner, and so there's greater incentive for the male to return to gainful employment sometimes than it is for the female to return to gainful employment. It's also been suggested that with the onset of debilitating symptoms is that because women play multiple roles in life, so for example, you know, that you're still the homemaker, the mother, the care of the husband and all that. And those activities or those responsibilities are maintained even though they're off work. And males, it's been suggested, often have no responsibilities other than watching television after work. And so, and so because of the multiple role demands on women, it's thought that sometimes debilitating health or mental health symptoms are going to be more likely to impact on the probability of return to work than it is for men.
Perhaps next year's mini science will be gender, an open battle. Everybody's been talking about it in the science.
One interesting gender thing we found with catastrophizing, where so in one study we have people come into our lab and we expose them to a pain stimulus, and we interview them afterwards about what we're interested in, what type of coping strategies that they might have been using while their arm was immersed in the water. And so, you know, we'd ask women, say, what was going through your mind? And women say, oh, you know, I was wondering whether this was going to damage my arm. I could feel the tingling going all the way up my arm. And I was wondering if this thing, you know, it can lead to an aneurysm and maybe you would die of it and that kind of thing. And I said, okay, that's alarmist thinking. And then we'd ask the men, say, well, what was going through your mind? They go, nothing. I said, wow, you know, your arm was in there for over a minute. Nothing. And we thought that we'd stumbled onto this phenomena that we refer to as the liberty from thought that only men experienced, and that it had analgesic properties.
That's the clip to save for the time capsule. Okay. You've been asked this a couple times already in different ways. So receiving money, long-term disability insurance, is obviously positive because then you have money, and it can serve as a deterrent, actually, to wanting to return to work. How would you deal with clients who would say, yeah, I want to interact with my friends and my colleagues and my family, but I want to keep on getting this money?
Okay, so clients who are being compensated for their disability and they're interested in doing more as a function of their participation in the intervention program, but they're not interested in going back to work because they're going to lose their compensation. And again, first I want to highlight that that characterizes such a small percentage of individuals that we have to be hesitant in the way that we're going to be painting disability with that kind of a brush. And some of the statistics I didn't talk about was that if you take a look at all the people who have musculoskeletal injuries, you know, so that, let's say if there's 100 people one day that all have a musculoskeletal injury at work, okay, well, 50% of those people are back at work within 2 weeks, 80% are back at work within 6 weeks. So for most, and all these people had access to compensation, and they all have the same condition. But for most of human beings, they want to see themselves as active participants in their life, as contributing in important ways to not just their own lifestyle, but contributing to society and community. That seems to be more the character of humanity than taking advantage of compensation systems. And in terms of people who are fabricating a system, it's like that's where the medical, legal, insurance context of disability can get really complicated and really nasty sometimes. So that it's insurers, to some degree, are convinced that there's a whole lot of people out there that are fabricating their disability in order to have access to financial resources. And I remember once I was asked by an insurance company to do a review of some cases, because I was living in Nova Scotia at the time, and they were going to be changing legislation about compensability of soft tissue injuries. And the insurer says, well, you know, our data suggest that at least 40% of our cases are fraudulent. And I said, why are you compensating fraudulent cases? And they said, well, we didn't know they were fraudulent. I said, okay, so what happened that you now know that they're fraudulent? Well, we had someone go through the files and decide if they were fraudulent or not. And they're going, what happens is that you can't tell, right? It's like it's for many debilitating health and mental health conditions, there's often no objective signs of the underlying condition. And so, for example, you couldn't say that someone is depressed because there's all these objective signs of it, is that you're going to be basing your diagnosis very much on clinical presentation. And that's true of many debilitating health and mental health conditions. And so for the most part, you know, it's like you have to take the person's presentation at face value, and actually more often than not, that's going to be an authentic representation of the client's condition. And a small percentage of the time is going to be inauthentic.
So before we get to our last question of the night, I'd like to remind people that a week from today, Mark Ware will be talking about Just Say No, with K-N-O-W, what marijuana has taught us about pain control. I don't know if samples are being provided. I'll just show up and that will be that. So we have the last question, which is mine. And So I just wondered, you've told us all your black arts. You've told us this is what we look for here, this is how I become, you know, your friend, and we work through it. So would that diminish the efficacy of the treatment of PGAP? Because all of us now, and in a few months everyone in TV land, will know how this works. Or does it still work despite that?
Okay, so despite the fact that I've told you that we use certain techniques strategically to engage clients, that we're going to be using a relationship to move a client forward, if you were the client hearing this, would this have an impact on your ability to benefit from the intervention program? And I guess it could, to some degree, in the same way that if I'm a psychologist and I'm starting to have mental health symptoms and I go see a psychologist, right? Well, I know all the tools he's got, so that when he says, can you tell me a bit about what you're expecting from treatment? I go, you're using that? Yeah, I say that too when I talk to clients. And so does knowing the techniques impact on the way that you're going to be responding? And probably, I would say, within the first few minutes it might. But I think that if you do your job well, even though I say that we're using techniques strategically, we're not using them deceptively, right? Our goal is still there to have at the end of our intervention a client who's going to be participating more fully in his or her life. And I believe that, and I'm hoping that the client also believes that that's my primary intent as well.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.